Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rave Waves Blog Talk Radio, a production of Rave Reviews Book Club. Today, Rave Waves presents Bring On the Spotlight. Now, I'm your host, John Fioravanti, coming to you from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Now, listeners, we want to hear from you, so join in the conversation on Twitter with your comments and questions using the hashtag RRBC Bring On the Spotlight. Again, that's hashtag RRBC Bring On the Spotlight. Now, there have been some people who've been experiencing an echo using Twitter during a show. If you experience that, all you do is right-click on the Twitter tab at the top of your browser, and this triggers a drop-down menu, and then click on the menu item that says Mute tab, and that will fix it. Now, chatting with us from Cornwall in the United Kingdom is our current Spotlight author, Jan Hawk. She's an amazingly supportive member. She's also RRBC secretary, and she's talented author of Malele Safari, An Eternal Journey. Now, this segment of Bring On the Spotlight is sponsored by Kim Cox, the very talented author of Get Out or Die. I want to thank you for joining us here at Rave Waves, Jan. It's such an honor to chat with you today.
I'm very pleased to be with you, John. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm really tickled that you agreed to join us on Rave Waves Blog Talk Radio all the way across the pond from Cornwall in the UK, and not to mention crossing a few time zones. But before we talk about your book and your thoughts about the writing process, please tell us about yourself. Apart from your role as an author, who is Jan Hawk?
Well, I'm a lady of leisure these days. I've retired from work and living on a neat little income that just about lets me do everything that I want to do and have a little bit over for things like a nice bottle of wine every now and then. And I live in a lovely little place that's very quiet and secluded, with a beautiful garden, and I have two canine companions who are currently being very well behaved. In fact, I think I must have drugged them without realizing it.
Oh, thank you, Jan. You know, your book, Malele Safari, An Eternal Journey, is a complex story set in Africa. And can you tell us a little bit about the plot without giving important things away?
Well, I have to be honest about my book because I know that it's not for everyone, as it does deal with some very tough subjects such as depression, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and therapies for that, which can be quite tough as well to go through, and also genocide. The book is, in fact, partially based on the conditions that created the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, and which kind of affected me because I was due to go to holiday in West Africa, in Namibia, and at the time, this was within about 4 weeks of our going, the conflict was still going on, and we very nearly cancelled the journey, but fortunately, the UN got in there finally and sorted things out so that it was business as usual again in the surrounding countries. But it's just been a long, long love affair and frustration with Africa, various countries in there that I've been to, which are mainly for safaris. But I've also been to North Africa a few times. And so I've seen this sort of Arabic side of the continent as well, and just the sort of impact it has had on me as a tourist, but also exposure to the culture there, where basically the human race first started and became civilized, basically, in Egypt and later down in places like Ethiopia. It's just a fascinating place to visit. And I love the wildlife, I love the landscapes, And I hate that it's so beset with so many horrible problems that keep the people in poverty and in ignorance.
Right. And I know you began that answer by saying, you know, this book isn't for everyone. And yet, you know, as I listen to you describe these things that inspired you when you wrote the book and were going on at the time, and I think to myself, well, it sounds like a very important book to read. Africa
is... I think that I keep a sort of thread of sanity and perspective through it, because it's about how people are dealing with the awful things that happen to them and through it in a positive way, and that's for everybody. The central incident in the book, and I'm just going into my Twitter account to give you the short summing up of what the book is about, because that's the one that I keep needing to remind myself of. It's the never-ending story of life, love, and death in the wild places of Africa. And that's the very, very short synopsis of what it's all about. And it basically, it's about life and how you live it. And in a lot of words, I've got some humour running through that. There's a love affair, there's a sad love affair and a happy one. There's all kinds of people, including a Hollywood film crew out in a pre-film movie safari to get to know their locations, which is going to be for a remake of The African Queen.
Right.
So there's all these sort of threads coming through to get across what Africa is all about and what makes it tick.
Well, you know, I'm thinking here as you're speaking that here we have a novel which is basically fiction with an awful lot of truth in it.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And that's why I made the comment that it sounds like an important book that we should be reading. Okay.
Yes, I mean, with the sort of the worst aspects of it were in some ways quite rewarding to write in some ways. There's a part where basically I view this murder in a refugee camp from all perspectives, including one of the people who was there to kill. And he was one of my favourite characters in the end, and I had all sorts of things planned for him, including a love affair with the other central character, who was the doctor whose boyfriend was killed in this camp. But I thought, no, that just wouldn't happen in real life. And I reined myself back, and I really did a number on how he would feel. From the research point of view, that was a really interesting thing to do, because I went into the archives online for the BBC reportage of the conflict in Rwanda.
Right,
and found a very, very interesting article from two people from the same town, one who had been a victim of the violence in the local church and had basically been in a coma in this church with hundreds of dead people all around her for a whole month before relief workers came in and managed to get her out and get her help her recover. And one of the people who had attacked them in that church had also had an article on him written, and he described how it was for him actually going into a church full of people that he actually knew as a neighbour and as people whose children's friends were friends with his children, literally people who were next door neighbours, and how he actually managed to get through that hell, which was hell for him as well.
Right.
And that got me thinking about how did they rehabilitate people after this kind of disaster that's very man-made and very, very dehumanising. And a lot of the book is sort of centred on how that they've processed that, because they dealt with it in a very, very strange way. It at first it seems in the mm-hmm. land by putting the killers back into their communities, because
right.
so many people have been killed that they were not able to get the crops in, they weren't able to look after the people who have been injured.
Right.
And so they basically put all the culprits in prison. A lot of them were executed. But
wow.
they had so many people who weren't actually as culpable, and they'd just been drawn into the killing sprees as a kind of survival trait, as it were, because if they didn't join in, they themselves might get killed. And it was just that whole sort of perspective of things, of how the killers were almost as damaged as the people they actually killed or mutilated.
Right, right.
I just thought, what a fascinating way to deal with it is to actually sort of send them back out into the community and get them working to support the people that they've injured the most.
Exactly.
And I think that what's happened in Rwanda is just staggering how they've actually coped with it and come out the other side, even though in pockets in other places the killing is still going on. They've actually managed to turn things around and come to terms with what happened to them. And they are making inroads into getting the country back up on its feet and successful again. And I think that that's a positive thing to come out of something that's so terrible.
Indeed. Such a horror story, Jen. I can't believe, what kind of inhumanity that people are capable of. But switching over to the Twitter feed, RBC member A.M. Benet is saying, so interesting to hear the stories behind the stories. And Margaret also told us a little earlier on the feed that she has a question for you, but I'm going to get to that a little later. So I'm not ignoring that. Beam
is
chiming in, and he's saying, Mulele Safari sounds like an intriguing read. Okay.
Yeah.
And John Howell chimes in, and he says, Mulele Safari has some heartbreaking moments, which Jan Hawk handles with grace.
Well, so thank you very much, John. And thank you, Beam, as well.
There you go.
There's good compliments coming from good writers there as well.
Well,
so
there you
very
go. Happy. I mean, good writers complimenting excellent writers. Okay. When discussing characters, you said that you want to make them as realistic as possible and give them flaws. Now, can you cite an example from one of your characters in this book?
Well, it's mainly Sophie, who's the doctor who's lost her boyfriend, who she was going to marry in this horrible incident. And she's basically out in Africa for a gap year stint with a voluntary organisation as an assistant teacher. And, of course, this devastates her and she has to be sent home. And basically she completely breaks down because of what's happened to her, because she's also had a miscarriage and nearly died with a dose of malaria. She went into a coma. So she's had a lot to deal with, and she gradually sort of comes to terms very, very gradually with what's gone on for her and how she's going to get herself out of it by treatment for depression. And she actually has a sort of life-changing decision of, instead of going to be a teacher, she would like to be a doctor. And she goes on to specialise in therapy for traumatic stress syndrome patients and also for tropical diseases. And she's goes through a very long training period, obviously, to train herself up as a doctor, and
mm-hmm.
then decides 13 years later, or more like 10 years later, but it takes another three more years to process it. She decides to go back to Africa to work for a relief organisation that she worked with before everything went wrong, and to join a new community that's been set up with the UN and other relief organisations to rehabilitate people affected by the Zaandan genocide, that I'm calling it in the book, and they need doctors and people who can actually treat people who've still got problems with flashbacks and generally sort of the nasty conditions that afflict people who've been subjected to extreme violence or war zones. And so she's confronting her demons basically by going back in and working with people near the place where her boyfriend had been murdered.
Right. Wow. I'm just looking at Twitter feed again. John Howell says, and this fits in with what we're speaking about right now, he says, the book also tells a story of forgiveness.
Yes. I mean, this is a 30-year journey to forgiveness for Sophie, because she had blamed the one character who is central but is dead throughout the book, Teresa Olatunde, who is a Nigerian nun and doctor who basically got the boyfriend killed because she reacted very strongly to how the refugees were being threatened in the camp, and she got attacked with a machete and he was gunned down trying to save her. And basically Sophie's found out what's happened and she's putting all the blame on Teresa when really it wasn't her fault as such, because she was only reacting in the only way she could to what was happening at the refugee camp. And so there's a lot of bitterness tied up into Sophie's character, and she never liked Teresa Olatunde, because Tom, her boyfriend, got on really well with her, and they were best friends before Sophie came out to work with them. And so there was always a big dose of jealousy involved in Sophie's relationship with Teresa.
Right.
And it was easy for her to blame her for her losses, basically. And I bring other characters into the book who've known Teresa when she was a small girl, and later in life when she was a nun and working as a doctor. Basically have a huge 360-degree examination of what happened and how people have come through it. And in the end, Sophie does forgive Teresa, because she sees a picture of her with a very as a very small child still with her godfather, who is smiling a smile that she also knew that Tom used to have. So that's why Teresa was so close to Tom and why she reacted so badly to what was happening in the camp when she got killed.
Right. Now, Sophie is your main character, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is she also your favorite character in the book?
She is mostly. I also liked another character that came upon me very quickly, because I hadn't intended to have her in it for very long at all, which was one of the women who were also in the refugee camp but survived. And she's the person who's actually in charge of this new community that's being... that Sophie goes to work in. And she was a bit of a revelation, really, because I hadn't planned for her to come back into the story at all. But then I thought of how events might have panned out when she was in the camp after the murder had taken place, and how she might have got through her own losses through the genocide that happened, and how she's got herself up to being in charge of quite an important and humanitarian setup in this new community.
Right.
So that's Verity Belashona, but she doesn't come back into the book until much later, near the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Now, you also said that you just love it when characters take over the keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
And I do, too. And, you know, as an author, I kind of sit back and laugh when it happens. So this begs the question, when you're working on a book, do you plan your characters in detail before you begin drafting the story, or do you let them evolve as the story progresses?
I think it's a kind of organic thing. I start out with a very loose outline of who's going to be in it, what they're going to do, and where it's going to end up. So
okay.
how it starts, how it ends, and kind of landmarks along the way, but nothing too firm. And with Malele, what happened with that is that Sophie got a new boyfriend all of a sudden about halfway through, and that was rather a surprise. And he was one of those characters that I had him giving them a lecture about how Kariba Dam was built in Zimbabwe and Zambia. And all of a sudden I had him flirting with Sophie, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I just went with it and wove him into another character's background who was planned, and the
right.
safari guide. Well, the group is in Zimbabwe. And, yeah, they're great fun. You just don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, my approach is very similar to yours, okay? And so I really identify with what you're saying here. I want to bring up a question that Anne Margaret brought up a little earlier on the Twitter feed. Do you have any projects in the works right now, Jan?
I do. It's one that I started last year and abandoned, basically, because of various things, but mostly because I was getting more and more into RRBC and trying to do a bit more work on promoting and marketing Malele. So I basically put it on hold. I've got 1.5 chapters in the can so far, but it's going to be a future fantasy with evolutionary genetics and conservation themes running through it based on Arthurian fantasy.
right. So that's kind of a departure from
yes,
what you started
my
with writing.
Because I'm a big fantasy fan. I read a lot of fantasy. And I'm one of these people who do pen and paper role play, Dungeons and Dragons style. And I'm in my spare time, I'm often an elf. But at the moment, I'm channeling a barbarian warrior hag that I've been tweeting about for this interview, actually. who is rather an aggressive young lady who wears lots of furs and tattoos and nasty sharp weapons, and she really gets me in the mood for writing for the Tomes of the Havenlands. It's going to be a series, at least three
okay.
books, possibly more, and it's going to be fun, I hope.
I was just wondering, you know, as we were sitting here, you know, talking about the new projects and the different genre, do you think, you know, when the series finally takes shape, that it'll be a little bit lighter than the darkness of Malele Safari?
It's going to be more. It's going to be more Game of Thrones than The
mm-hmm.
Hobbit. Put it that way.
Okay.
But,
okay.
yeah, it is in a way, because it's like you're sort of roaming through your own world and you're in charge, and it's exciting to actually build it all up and,
okay.
and get it all working. I may have bit off more than I can chew, though.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like it's going to be exciting and a lot of fun. Now, Jan, you know, you're coming up on your second anniversary in April as a member of Rave Reviews Book Club.
Yes.
And for the last part of that time, you've been serving on the governing board as secretary. So what I'd like to know is, why did you join in the first place? What got you to join? And what has your experience been as a member so far?
Right. The reason I wanted to join was because of the review aspect mostly. And I didn't really sort of grasp at first how important the support side of it was in terms of marketing and promotion, which is something that I historically always shy away from. But writing books, as we all know, if we're indies, is not just about writing it. It's about how it's put out and how you get people to read it. And one of the things I had worked out for myself when I put out Mileli at the end of 2013 was that reviews on Amazon help an awful lot towards you in the rankings, even if you're not putting out too much in the way of sales, especially on e-books, of course, because the markup there is so small anyway that the percentage on that is negligible anyway.
Right.
So I was very attracted to the idea of reviews and proper reviews where you're sort of buying the book and actually reading it and reading it all and giving it an honest review at the end of the day. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea because I run out of friends that I can ask to read the book, basically. And because of the problems I have in just describing what it's all about, I thought this is a good way to actually sort of connect with other people who are interested in reading different things. And so that was what got me in. It then took me a few, well, probably 4 or 5 months before I wondered how people were getting themselves on the Book of the Month list and all these wonderful things like Spotlight Author and Push Tuesdays. And I finally cottoned on that it's because they were going out on Twitter and Facebook and actually helping other people's books come to people's attention. So I joined this Twitter support team because that made me go on Twitter because I was very, very shy of going on there. I didn't get it at all really at first, but I soon got into the swing of it and I went from 28 followers to something like 1,000 quite quickly in a couple of months. In fact, I was up to 300 about the day after I went on Twitter, so that was just fantastic and I quite enjoyed doing the
So it's been a pretty
enjoyed doing the team things and it just led up from there. I was enjoying so much sort of giving people support and the whole sort of concept of it that I wanted to do more, and that's how I became the site monitor at first and then secretary when Nonnie was asking for help in the weekly club update.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very rewarding thing to do.
Well, that's wonderful. And the bad thing is right now, it's unfortunately we need to wrap things up, Jan. We're just running out of time here.
I thought we might be.
I want to thank you for visiting us today. You know, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you better and to shine the spotlight on your wonderful book, Mileli Safari, An Eternal Journey. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
And now it's time to support another indie author and pay some bills at the same time.
Get Out or Die is the second novella in the Lana Malloy Paranormal Mystery Series by Kim Cox. Lana Malloy is a psychic private investigator who is on a mission to help the dearly departed, even when they don't realize they need help. In the first novella, Haunted Hearts, Lana set out to solve her first case, the 20-year-old cold case and double murder of her great-aunt and her great-aunt's love. With the help of the ghosts themselves and a new love interest, Lana was able to prove just how useful her unique skills could be. In Get Out or Die, the success of Lana's first case has spread to local residents, and her business is booming. But soon, she learns of a frightening new ability, an ability which could give the spirit the upper hand if Lana's not careful. Will Lana be able to control the situation, or will the ghost sense he can overtake her? And if that isn't stressful enough, Lana's fiancé is pressuring her to set a wedding date. Will she marry Tony, or will her latest dangerous case make that decision unnecessary? Find out on July 1st with the new release of Get Out or Die. For more information, visit kimcoxauthor.com.
Well, this is your host, John Fioravanti. I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in today and listening to Bring On the Spotlight, a Rave Waves production. And I want to ask you to please join us again for the next episode of Rave Waves Blog Talk Radio, where all things literary are our passion. I want you all to have an amazing day, and thank you very much for listening in again. Bye-bye for now.
Hi, I'm Robbie. I'm a mechanical fitter apprentice at Babcock. I came straight from school with a maths, English and science GCSE. I love it. I'm in my second year and every day I learn something new. I enhance my skills, the pay's good and the teachers are supportive. I feel like it's boosted my confidence and I love the independence it gives me. If you're thinking about joining Babcock as an apprentice, don't just think about it, do it. You'll be spoilt for choice with all the trades to choose from. I'm a Babcock apprentice and I'm built in Plymouth.
Visit builtinplymouth.co.uk to find out more about Robbie's story and how you could be a Babcock apprentice.